Good morning. So using types effectively. So what does that mean is the first question. So if you look back at the recent evolution of C++, from one point of view, it's largely about increasing our capabilities for dealing with types. And that means things like massive expansion of type traits with 11, things like decal type, auto, we've got null putter now, and scoped enums. We've got the GSL giving us more type safety. We've got the concepts TS coming up. So one of the things that you hear a lot at conferences lately is like how C++ is getting things from functional languages. So I wanted to reassure you that this talk isn't about any of these things, which you might think about when you think about functional languages. And in particular, not the M word. But functional languages like ML and Haskell do have lots of things they can teach us about types. In particular, using them expressively and effectively. And a key thing is making illegal states unrepresentable and making illegal behavior be a type error. And so that was kind of the evolution of this talk. C++ is definitely moving in this direction, in my opinion. And so, well, the first thing question is, what is a type? So when I've asked this question, I get lots of different answers. Some potential answers might be, one of the original motivations for putting types in C that Dennis Ritchie had was that the new hardware was supporting floating point, and so his compiler needed a way to figure the difference between integers and floating points to know what opcode to output. A lot of people, because we're C++ programmers and because we're concerned with performance and because we come from the background of C, we tend to think about types as in a very representational manner, i.e. the way the data is stored in the memory. Another way we can think about it is sort of the object-oriented sort of view of types, so characterizing what operations are possible and perhaps what are not possible, or determining the values that we can assign to something, or in some way determining the semantic meaning of the data. Now, just note about the representational viewpoint. One of my friends tweeted and gave me grist for this talk and said, or Facebook, and said, only Lua would have one equal true, evaluate to false, hashtag want my day back. This is back in April. So of course I replied, how can one be equal to true? In my best, functional programmer hat. One is an integer, true is a Boolean, they can't be equal. Lua is correct here, and it's your view of the world that's warped. And I put a smiley face, so he's still my friend. So in this talk, I want to take a little look about how just a little bit of type theory can help us think about better APIs and more closely modeling our data. And so I want you to think about a type being a set of values that can inhabit a given expression. And to that end, it might be finite, like a Boolean, or infinite, like a vector. But in some sense, a type is characterized by the cardinality of the set, the number of things we can fit into that bucket. And types in this sense are static. They are things that expressions have and therefore things that programs have. So I mark this talk as a tutorial because you're going to do some work here. So let's play a little game to help get us thinking about types. So I'll tell you a type and you're going to tell me how many values it has. So how many things can fit in that bucket. And there are no tricks here. If it seems obvious, it's because it is. Shout it out, I'll try and listen. So types of sets of values is level one of the game. How many values here? Two, right, two, obvious, right? Good. Level one, traditionally easy. How about now? 256, yes. You're a very smart crowd, of course you are, you're at CPCon. But it does get a little harder. How many values now? I heard zero, I heard one. I'm still hearing zero and one, so there's some confusion, there's some disagreement. So there's a proposal to make it a regular type, it's true. You certainly can't instantiate a value of void, but you can return it from a function. Here's another way of making a type that has zero inhabitants. And here, this rather curious construction is yet another way. Yeah, there's some confusion because you can return it from a function, but you can't instantiate a value of type void. So, you know, maybe BASIC had it right. BASIC had this function versus procedure thing. People of my age tended to start with BASIC. Maybe BASIC was correct there. All right, so some confusion about void, but I'm gonna say zero for this talk. How many values now? One. Yes, I heard one, one. Any value of this type you can make is indistinguishable from any other value, so it's one. How about now? Three. Oh, or 256, someone says. A representational thinker in the room. The answer is three. So if you were to make, it's true, this is, in the memory, this is a byte, right? So if you were to make a value, you could cast it to a Fireswarp Danger, and it could be, effectively, at that point, you would have broken the semantic link between the type and the representation. So I'm saying that's not a member of this type. This type has three members. And that this situation is somewhat similar to what we think of as an unconstructed object. So after the memory's been reserved, but the constructor hasn't yet run, the representation is, you know, what you're gonna, the memory is there, but you haven't yet turned it into an object. You haven't yet turned it into a member of the type. Okay, so three. And now, how many values are there of foo? What can we say? I heard cardinality of t. So we can say about this type foo that it has as many values as t has, whatever that might be. For it, whatever we instantiate it with, it's gonna have as many values. All right, so that was level one. And already we're seeing, so if we think about types as being the number of things we can put in the bucket, then we can say that these two types are equivalent. And I hope we can all agree on this point. You can do anything with a bool that you can do with an innator button in this case. So let's move on to level two. When we think about aggregating types. So how many values are there of the pair? 512, because you multiply 256 by two. Yes. How many values of foo? Again, same thing, 512. So exactly equivalent to the pair. And now how many values of the tuple? Eight, again, because two times two times two. Now how many values of foo are there? All right, cardinality of t times cardinality of u, yes. Good. You're a very smart crowd. This is great. That's the end of level two. So in type theory, this is called a product type just because you're literally multiplying the number of inhabitants. And we've had this in C++ and indeed in C for, you know, decades. That's your struct, pairs, pupils, whatever you want in modern speak, but it's all the same thing. So on to level three. Now level three is something that's new in C++. How many values of an optional char? 257, I hear, loud and clear. Because optional gives you the one extra value. It gives you the sentinel value outside of your type. And we add them together. Now, how many values in the variant? 258, yes. I hear a general consensus. 258, again, same reason. Char, 256 plus bool, 258. And so now how many values in foo? I think I'm hearing generally the sum of the cardinalities of t and u, right? So that's new in C++, right? Variants and optionals. And this kind of thing is called a sum type in type theory, and it's just because you sum them together. So level four is a little bit harder, I have to say, than levels one, two, and three. But you're smart, so I'm sure you'll get it. So how many values are there of the function f? That is to say, how many different ways can we write f? Syntax aside, but I hear two, I think I heard four. If you don't count side effects. Someone said 2 times 2. Yes. So 4 is the answer, the one that I'm going with. Here are the 4 ways we could write the function. So what we're saying when we're saying different ways to write the function, we're saying different number of ways to draw the arrows between inputs and outputs. And so I hope you can see that these are the 4 ways. And in C++, these 4 functions might look something like this. We can simply always return true, always return false. That would be F2 and F3 here. And F1 is just identity, and F4 is complement. Happy? Okay. Now slightly harder. How many ways can we write F now? Somebody says 512 because right, because 2 times 2 is 56. So not quite. 256 squared is the correct answer, yeah. Because if we look back at this picture, you can see that, imagine that this is, what are we saying, bool to char. We can draw the first arrow 256 ways, and then we can draw the second arrow another 256 ways. We multiply them together. So how many values for F now? I hear 256 cubed from somewhere on the left-hand side. And that is correct. So in this case, foo has 3 values. Char, obviously 256. Raise the 1 to the power of the other. Yes, you're right. So the function has to be well-formed is the comment. And what we mean is that the function is, so for the same input, it always gives the same output. Yes, it doesn't rely on external side effects, global variables you might have hidden away. It's referentially transparent. All right, so number of values of a function, there's a number of different ways we can draw arrows between the inputs and the outputs in this sense. So how many values now of F, which takes T's to use. What can we say? Right, I think you're saying it, which is number of values of U to the power of number of values of T, which is what we've seen before in the previous examples. Okay, so that's the end of level 4. And when we have a function from A to B, we raise the number of inhabitants of B to the power of number of inhabitants of A. And just as an aside, this is a corollary as to why the equivalence of curried functions to uncurried functions. I'm going to skip over that and give you guys an achievement. All right, so that in that little game, we already saw some equivalences, right? So we can, where we would previously have, let's say, a bar here, holding a T and a bool to say what kind of T it is, we have a choice now in modern C++, in 17s it will be, to represent that as a variant. And I think the variant will very soon become a very important tool for proper expression of our business logic states, and this talk kind of talks to that. And you know, this is one of the reasons why it's important that variant is kind of never empty or only empty in error state, so that it can, you know, have this kind of equivalence. So another thing to note about this is that, so obviously in the variant case, we would think of T plus T. And in the case of bar here, it's T times 2, which is the same. But if we modeled our data with bar, we'd have to keep those two variables in sync everywhere we changed them. And the variant is an easy way to do that. So this is what it means. You've seen a little bit of this. This is what it means to have an algebra of data types. We can reason about equality of types, and we can find equivalent formulations that might be natural or better performing or in some way more easily understood. And crucially, we can kind of identify and get rid of these mismatches that we have right now between our business logic state space and the types that we have to use to implement our logic. If we can make the types match more closely the state space of the logic, we eliminate whole classes of errors because we make illegal states unrepresentable. And this is a big reason why I think that std variant is a game changer and probably the most important thing since lambdas. Okay, well, let's look at some examples of that. So using sum types as well as product types that we know and love to look at alternative formulations. So here's an example. Of course, all examples are contrived, but this perhaps isn't too far from some stuff, massively simplified, that you find in everyday code bases. We're trying to model a connection. So we've got some kind of state of the connection, and in all likelihood, it would have more states than this, having proliferated over the course of, I don't know, 5 years or so. So we've got an enum for the state, and then we've got an address of a server we're connected to. We've got some kind of ID for the connection. And then we've got some idea of when we got connected and what our last ping time was. And we've got a reconnect timer for the case where we get the connection interrupted. So already you can see that, you know, some of these fields that we have aren't valid in various connection states. Like when we're disconnected, we don't have a connected time. Or in fact, you know, what tends to happen is that that field gets reused as a disconnected time, sort of without being commented or enforced. Obviously, we wouldn't have a last ping time if we were disconnected, and we'd only have a reconnect timer if we were interrupted. So we could change this around using variant to more closely model our state space. So it might look something like this. So now, rather than having just the enum for the states, we turn the states themselves into structs, and we make the variant over those structs. And so each struct contains just the things that are valid for just that state. So when we're connected, we have connected time. When we're interrupted, we have a disconnect time now, which is explicit, and a reconnect timer, and all the other things you can see here. And so with this formulation, which is in some sense, you know, exactly equivalent in terms of the business logic state space, we've narrowed in the actual state space the variables are able to represent. So we've eliminated a bunch of bugs, hopefully. Well, hopefully we didn't have the bugs in the first place, but we're all human. So here's another example, common example perhaps, a nullable field. If you have a, you know, if you, let's say you have a social network and there's a friend construct and you're able to give them an alias, and that gets stored on the server. You don't know yet whether you've got the alias from the server. You don't, these two fields need to be kept in sync, right? So everywhere you touch the alias, when you get it from the server, you need to put alias populated. There's a temptation for code to treat empty aliases as unpopulated, but that might not be correct. You know, sometimes a general thing here is that often there's no good sentinel type to use within the type here. Often we use empty string as the sentinel type to mean, you know, invalid or whatever, but in this case, it might not be. So if we replace this with an optional, now we get exactly that behavior. What optional does is gives you that sentinel value. And it's not possible for two fields to get out of step now because there's only one field. You fill it in when you get the value from the server. If you haven't got the value from the server yet, you haven't got it yet. Here's another made-up example. Let's say you're programming some monster AI for a game, and you've got a very simple monster AI. A monster can be idle, just waiting around in the world, or it can aggro when a player gets close to it and chase it for a while before it gives up or, you know, closes and makes and becomes fighting. Again, an enum for the state. The fields other than that enum are applicable in some states and not in others. For example, an idle monster has no target, and a fighting monster has no chase timer. So again, we're seeing the kind of thing that happens every day in code, but the state space of the variables doesn't match the state space of the business logic. And so using variant, again, all we do, convert it into structs, let the structs be the enum, effectively, that is contained within the variant, and now we can put the right things in the right states. So So the question is, don't you have a bug here, when a chance for a bug here, if you don't copy your target from chasing to fighting? So weigh that against the bug you would have of accidentally leaving the target populated when you're in an idle state and some piece of code checking that instead of the state. I think it's easier to perform an assignment in the variant between chasing and fighting in that sense than it is previously. You have a definite state transition. Yeah.
In terms of performance, is it guaranteed that targets will be allocated in the same space, or maybe you have to do two assignments in place?
Great question. I get that same question on a practice run. The question is, I think, if you are going from the chasing state to the fighting state, is there any performance gain, or is there, do you have to assign from target to target? Do you have to tear down and reconstruct? It depends on the variant implementation. I think the answer is that pretty much you tear down and reconstruct. So in that case, you might want to factor out a subclass of chasing and fighting, which is engaged, maybe, and contains the target. There are things you can do. Can you access a variant with a subclass? Well, you would put these subclasses into the variant, and they would share the other one. You might still get a construct, though. These are implementation issues I'm not sure about. Okay, so there are a few examples. Some types, now that we have them, naturally kind of model several design patterns, which we're used to as well. So I thought I'd go back and take a look at those. In particular, I think these four. So command is really nothing more than one big variant. It's typically, you have a very wide, flat hierarchy, and you have basically, it might have been replaced by function or something, but you have some kind of executable command, and then you have a bunch of different commands with states. That is really nothing more than a big variant. Composite, again, treating part whole hierarchies the same, very much suited to modeling with a variant, I think. State is basically variant. And interpreter also is something that very well modified, modeled by variants. If you think about a JSON object, that's one large recursive variant. An interpreter, is a pattern that allows you to kind of visit that. This is kind of what I've been saying. When you make your types match your state space of your business logic, you get rid of tons of bugs. Also, you get rid of tons of tests that kind of tested all those corner cases, because the corner cases just no longer exist. The types don't allow the corner cases anymore. So let's take a look at designing with types. So fitting types to their functions is kind of what we want for unsurprising behavior, right? So this is important. The bigger the code base is and the more vital the functionality is. So what you want to do when you look at a function is know from the arguments, basically, what it does. Ideally, we could look at a function and know what it does just by knowing that it has to use its arguments and it has to use them in a certain way to achieve what it returns. And so if you use this kind of approach to make your APIs, then it becomes much more understandable to yourself in the future and other programmers. So let's take a look at, we've looked at types modeling data. Let's take a little look at types modeling behavior. One technique for doing this is broadly known as phantom types. And it basically makes illegal behavior become a type error. So here is an example of an injection bug just waiting to happen. And I'm sure you can all see why. We've got get form data and execute query and sanitize form data. If we ever forget to call sanitize form data on the result of calling get form data, then Our company just died. We lost millions of dollars. We lost our database, whatever. This is a big deal. Bobby Tables is not our friend. So how can we use types here to prevent this bad behavior? So here's kind of the setup, right? So the phantom type here is T. Now, I think you can see why it's called a phantom type. It doesn't actually appear anywhere in the representation. It just appears as a template parameter. And form data itself is nothing more than a string, so the compiler is just going to, you know, optimize everything away. This is just using types at compile time. And then we have these two tag structs, which could also be non-type template parameters if we wanted to. There's alternative ways to formulate this. But now we can write our code like this. So form data is born dirty, and we can only execute clean data. And so it's not possible to have an injection bug here. You must call sanitize form data in order to convert, you know, the dirty to the clean. Maybe. There's an option. I put in an optional there because you might want to do that. So you can constrain, you know, first of all, you don't accidentally get any problems here. Secondly, you can constrain your tests. If as long as sanitized form data is tested, you can narrow in on that part, and that's the part you really need to look at, right? So you've kind of narrowed your space for what you need to test, and you've made sure that in the wider code base, you know, the compiler is enforcing that you actually can't have this type of bug. And this kind of technique of phantom types is also useful for things like units libraries, you know. So you wouldn't want to accidentally add meters to kilograms, and so you might use a phantom type. They both be, you know, integral or floating point types, but you might use a phantom type to wrap it around and make sure you can't add the one to the other. Something like a strong type def. And as I was writing this talk, I realized that effectively enum class is a strong type def for integral types. So we've looked at types modeling data, we've looked at types modeling behavior. I want to play another game with you guys now to show you the value of total functions, which is to say functions that are defined on all inputs, or alternatively in C++, we might say functions with no preconditions. Now, that's not the same, it's not the same as saying that, you know, so for example, min here is a function or a function template. Not every T will satisfy what's required for min. Not every T is ordered, right? So I'm not saying, when I say total function, I'm not saying that min here is instantiable with every type. I'm saying that, you know, the concept still applies that T must be orderable. But you can see here the difference between min and square root, perhaps. So if we have an ordered type, it's clear that for any two values of that type, we could compute min. Square root, on the other hand, is a partial function because it's undefined for negatives, right? So the state space of float is twice as big as square root supports, if you like. So there are requirements on the type here, but the sort of regular, normal requirements you would expect. There's nothing surprising. The types, you can assume that the types in the upcoming slides are regular, and you can assume that the functions actually do something interesting as opposed to something boring. So let's play another game to see how total functions result in really unsurprising code. Now, I'm going to give you guys almost nothing to work with. I'll just give you bare function signatures with nothing attached, and you'll be able to know instantly what it is and how to implement it. And the only rule is that it's got to be a total function. So there are no tricks, but remember that rule. And as always, there are ways to screw things up in C++ and make unexpected things happen, but assume there's nothing surprising going on. All right, here's the first function. What would we call this? Identity. Yeah, I would call this identity. Now, this is sort of an odd one, because for any given instantiation of this function, so the function template, we can say definitely that's identity, right? Because it pretty much has to return the thing I give it. It really couldn't do anything else. You know, default constructing something wouldn't be interesting. We assume it uses its argument. But for any given instantiation, we know nothing about what f does for integers. It could do anything, because in a strange way, we know nothing about t, and so we can say its identity, but we know a whole lot about ints, and so we can't say anything about that function. Sort of an oddity. All right, next function. What would we call this?
First.
Yep, I think we call it first. How about this one? First or second, choose, yeah, select. I think we'd call something like that. So the idea is that it uses its Boolean argument to select which of the two other arguments to return. What might we call this? Map? You might call it map if you're writing in Haskell, maybe, I don't know. apply, I heard apply, or execute, or call, maybe. Yep. How about this one? I heard transform. I heard sort. Identity, yeah, identity would be the boring option. Generate, interesting. Shuffle, yeah, so the basic idea here, I think it could be reverse, it could be shuffle. With the right concepts on T, it could be sort. The idea is that we don't really know what we can do with T, but we know what we can do with vectors, right? So we can change around the vector any way we like, and we assume that the T's are regular and copyable or movable. So yeah, and you know, so with these functions, the standard library writes these in terms of iterators, but you know, for the sake of ease, I'm writing them in terms of just containers and types. But they're equivalent. How about this one? Reduce and accumulate. Well, F, I don't see F taking a operation, so. Front or back? I have front. Scan average. Okay, so let's assume the function only does what you give it. It doesn't have anything hidden. Front or back is a good guess. Min or max, potentially, if t, although this function isn't actually possible. What do you return if you have an empty vector? So by looking at the types, this function shouldn't be possible. I mean, you might say, return a default constructed t. And then I would say, what if your type has no sentinel in it? You know, what if your type is a color? You know, you might say return black, but that, you know, that's a cromulent color I use elsewhere in my code. So I said there were no tricks, but I did warn you. But the odd thing is that this function actually exists. So like, and of course, front has preconditions, which is that the vector mustn't be empty, which is another way of saying it's a partial function. All right, and you know, perhaps if we're writing STL2, we would look at something like this, and then we would call it front. How about this? Map. Map, say the functional programmers. And the C++ programmers say transform. Yeah, so a vector of t's and a function to make t's into u's, and we give back the vector of u's, and you can all see, obviously, how that works. And sure, again, not in terms of iterators, but effectively the same. How about this one? Again, the functional programmer says filter. yeah, or in C++, we would, it could be more than filter, it could be a few things. It takes a predicate and a vector and returns a vector of the same type of thing. So it could be, we would call it something like remove if, or perhaps partition. You know, basically it has that predicate to run over the vector and do something. How about this one? It's not total. Yes, now you're getting it. Because if what would you return if you didn't have something in the opt, if you had the null opt? What would you return? So yeah, that's not possible by the types alone. Again, in C++, anything is possible, but I'm just trying to look through a type lens. So how about this one? This get value lookup, someone said. Yeah. Ah, someone's catching on. Yes, this is impossible because the key might not be in the map. But again, this exists. And anyone who's tried to use this on a const map will know that this exists. So perhaps, you know, if we were writing STL2, we might think about this. And we would call it lookup. Yeah, and we wouldn't have to have things in maps be default constructible, at least not for that. So, what just happened? I gave you almost no information. There were no function names here, there were no variable names, there were even no type names, there were no concepts. I just gave you the barest of type signatures that I could possibly give you. And you instantly knew everything about these functions, what they should be called, how to implement them. And with the proviso that partial functions gave us a few issues. So, you know, naming is one of the hardest problems in computer science. If we don't need to, if we can infer the action of our functions just from the types, it makes naming a whole lot easier, and you can sort of identify, well, not that it makes naming easier, but it makes figuring out what the function does easier and naming become less important even. The names of the types become more important. Perhaps so. So naming is still important. I'm not saying it's not important, but at least when we look at functions that are well typed, we have no surprise about what they do. And perhaps we have that holy grail of self-documenting code, at least in some cases. So I hope you can see from this that if you write functions without preconditions, that is total functions with well-typed signatures, it makes them a whole lot easier to use. It makes your APIs unsurprising, safer to use, harder to misuse. And as I was saying before, whole categories of tests sort of vanish if your types simply can't express the edge cases that they used to be able to, you know, because the types didn't fit the business logic. So a little bit about testing. So last year I talked about unit testing and in particular property-based testing. And I have a little library that does that. If you get your types right, what you're doing is saying, you know, the property-based tests effectively say, for all values, this property is true. Whatever I feed to my function, this property has to be true. So that is exactly what types are. Types are universal quantifications about what you can do. And so types, I think, scale better than tests. So instead of test-driven development, try type-driven development. I found it useful. Now, C++'s type system isn't yet quite powerful enough to say goodbye to all tests, and it's doubtful that any type system ever would be. But it's certainly already powerful enough that if we use it effectively, we can reduce some of the drudgery of writing tests just by making sure that it's a compile error instead. So if you want to go further down the rabbit hole, here's a few links that you can get from the slides. And here's a couple of quotes. Thank you very much for listening. Since we still have some time, I have a little epilogue, a little other taste for you guys. So a little taste of algebra with data types. So back to this question. How many values are there of a vector of t? Or what can we say about this? Someone said Aleph naught. Memory permitting? Sure. Yeah, but I'm saying if we say infinite, that's a little imprecise. finite, yes. So can we, in some sense, narrow in on how many values of t there are? This is a tricky one. One thing that functional languages do is they tend to define sequences recursively, right? And the way that works is you say that a vector of t, or you know, a list of t in functional languages, is, so one here is representing what? Empty, right, empty vector. And then we add it together, we alternate that. So it's either an empty vector or a t as the head of another vector, right? A t and the tail of, the tail is another vector. So here we have an equation representing the type of a vector. So once we have that, we can go to town with our high school math. So, and we can say, right, let's rearrange. Take that over to the left, do that, divide through, and we get this thing. 1 over 1 minus t, that's our expression, right. Well, what the heck does that mean? I don't know how to take away types, let alone divide them. So, okay. What do we do when we don't know how to deal with something mathematical? Ask Wolfram Alpha. Let's ask Wolfram Alpha what this means. Oh, I gotta ask on over here. Do I have a mouse cursor? I do. All right. Let's see what Wolfram Alpha says. Hopefully it will say something enlightening. All right, so it says a bunch of stuff, and I don't know if you can see, so we scroll down. Ah, then we see this thing, series expansion at t equals 0. 1 plus t squared plus t cubed, etc. Will that work? Yes. So that is interesting. Even though we didn't know what to do with that, this looks an awful lot like a vector can be either one element or empty or one element or two elements or three elements or four elements. So even though we didn't know how to take away types, how to divide types, that expression was sort of meaningless. In some sense, mathematics gave us the right answer, which is odd. Okay, so here are my goals for well-typed code, if you like. I really think that the addition of some types to C++ is a game changer, as important as lambdas, for modeling our state spaces and making illegal states unrepresentable. I think that phantom types is one way that you can make illegal behavior a compile error, and that can only be a good thing. And I think that writing total functions is to be desired for unsurprising behavior and APIs that are easy to use and hard to misuse. And if there are any questions, I'll take them. But thank you very much.
So how do you feel, hypothetical STL2, to have partial functions alongside total functions for performance reasons, like unsafe lookup or unsafe, from?
So how do I feel in a hypothetical STL2 to have both the partial functions and the total functions, the partial functions maybe for reasons of performance. I feel that total functions should certainly be a default. I think that if you're arguing performance, you need to measure things. And so, you know, I think the case, for example, the performance of needing front be have the precondition rather than returning an optional. You know, if you need that performance, yes. But I would certainly like to have the total functions be front and center. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the comment is that many of the functions in the library are partial because they were designed before lambdas, and if you, am I getting it right? If you were to pass a lambda into the function, it could effectively inject the behavior you wanted in the case where the partiality might apply. Okay. I would still say that, you know, there are cases where, in fact, quite a lot of cases when you start to look at it where there are a lot of cases we have right now where we sort of shoehorn in some kind of sentinel value into our type just for reasons of needing a sentinel value, whether that be, you know, -1 or some kind of default constructed thing. And I think we jump through hoops to get default construction on more types than we needed on because of this limitation that we need default construction and sentinel values to be inside our functions inside our containers. So I still think that you know, in terms of modeling types, things like optional are really important. Yeah, Matt. Right, so the question is about replacing exceptions or error codes with variants, or, you know, so effectively a pair, or maybe, or as it might be before variant. That's a valid way to go. I think you need more machinery for, I mean, when you get to that, you're almost talking about then using, like we have, I've heard of things like std expected, you're using a kind of monadic error mechanism. So that's totally fine if you're comfortable with that. I think. What are the pros and cons? Let's talk about it afterwards, maybe. I think we can't ignore that exceptions and error codes are kind of in a lot of library code already, in a lot of code. You know, maybe if you were to take a greenfield thing and no dependencies, you could write in C++ a performant monadic kind of error handling deal. Right. I mean, so if the promise is it could improve performance, well, maybe. I'd hate to write a whole big system and then find out that it didn't improve performance. It's happened to me once or twice, but in the back.
For strings, you allowed the current version of the string, the empty string was permitted explicitly. How do you handle optional just increasing the number of sample checks?
So in the example of string, I said that we often use empty string as a sentinel value. Yeah. So the question was how. What was the question?
I've seen people use optional where they also have sentinel value and empty is not allowed. And then you just have to check more conditions.
Oh, you've seen people use optional where the type itself also had a sentinel value and empty wasn't allowed.
Empty
is the sentinel?
Yeah.
Right, and I think that's what I was advocating. So optional provides your type with a sentinel value.
Optional of T star, right?
Then you have to check
what
Yes, yes. If you have option of a pointer, you have to check whether you have null opt and then whether the pointer's null. Yeah, this is, I mean, a pointer really historically is an optional in that sense, because the practice of using a null pointer as the sentinel value, after all, it is inaddressable, is well, you know, well used. For pointers, pointers are effectively optionals. What to do with pointers is a whole different thing, perhaps. And I would use the GSLs not null, maybe. I would basically, yeah, I wouldn't layer on optional on top of optional. Michael, did you? Oh, sure, yeah, I mean, I guess so. That's true. So Michael's point is that in some targets, embedded systems maybe, null is actually in a piece of addressable memory and perfectly fine. So you wouldn't necessarily have a sentinel in your pointer type. Yeah, Hinan. So the comment is that Hinan's concern is that using total functions may, when business logic changes, may result in more of a rewrite than using partial functions. Maybe true. And so I guess it's your choice how closely you want your types to fit your problem domain. And if you want some laxity there so that you anticipate your domain changing, then you are trading off, you know, development time for safety in some sense. Yeah.
I didn't understand your explanation of one of your slides earlier from your function where you had.
Okay.
You had the function that took a bool and returned a char. I understand the math of the 256 squared, but if your rules said there was no other state, it was just what was passed in, so how could you possibly have more values than you only could pass in two?
Okay, so the function that takes a bool and returns a char has 64k ways to write it, right? 256 times 256, or 256 squared. So maybe I can explain. So here I have a bool. This is true and false, and maybe there's 256 of you. How many ways could I give these out? I could give them both to the same person. I can give the first one any number of 256 ways, and then I can independently give the second one 256 ways. Okay.
According to your rules, there was no other state to make the decision. So how could you possibly have that if all you can deal with is the state passing function?
I see. So I mean, any given instance of the function only obviously does one thing. But the point is that the type of the function has 64k possible ways, possible inhabitants, possible ways to write that function. Is that coming across? Sorry? One of the possible ways to write the function would be to hard code returning the char, yes. Yeah, that was way back, I think. So,
yeah, he explained it to me in a way that it's the number of different ways the function could be implemented, not the number of ways you could get output.
Right, right. So the type of the function affords a certain number of implementations.
Okay, that's clear.
Getting close. Yeah, this slide, I hope, makes that clear. So the number of values the function can have is the number of ways of drawing those two arrows. Okay, we're at time. Thank you all very much.